Welcome to the Senate Interim Committee on Education Workforce Development, meeting jointly with our colleagues here today.
Thank you, Senator, and welcome to the House Interim Committee on Higher Education, meeting with our colleagues from the other chamber. Happy to be here today. We've got an informational meeting. We're going to have an update from some members of the Oregon Education Investment Board, and we have a couple of their key figures here, Matt Donegan, Dr. Rudy Crew. So if you both would like to approach the dais, that'd be fabulous. And Ben Cannon, obviously, is here as well.
He's here to take the tough questions.
Yes, you're right. Absolutely right.
Go ahead. Please proceed.
Thank you very much. Rudy Crew, Chief Education Officer for the Oregon Investment Board. I wanted to just maybe use my time to frame what essentially is a body of work that, for the most part, has been threaded in many a conversation thus far, some individually with members and others perhaps more generally through various forums and other engagements. But I do think it bears an important sort of stake in the ground as a way of being able to understand that this conversation really is sort of a tandem conversation. It's an organizational conversation around this work and how it ultimately effectively and efficiently would be proceeded, but it's also a conversation about the substance of the work. And to a large degree, the governor's budget, I think, really does begin the deeper conversation around what that body of work is. You've heard us talk for now many days or weeks about the issue of literacy and Oregon Reads. I know that my board has expressed their desire to really want to take aim at this question of early literacy in particular, parents and parent support and training, so that they really are the bedrock of support for children as they become from zero really to, or neonatal, if you will, to grade three. We've got to do a better job of getting far more of our students proficient by grade three. And so this body of work really does have a set of metrics and a real important sort of base and foundational core to the ultimate set of issues that we'll be talking about as we talk about the whole P20 system. But if we get it right at the early learning stages, and if we particularly get it right in the content area of reading, then the question becomes, well, what guidance and support are needed for young people to then think in terms of a post-secondary or career opportunities that they want to avail themselves of? And it's in those words that I would suggest that really is the centerpiece of the next piece of work here, that we really do see that we've got to get the foundation right, but then in getting the foundation right, provide guidance and support for young people to make critical choices about their career aspirations, about their career and technical skill sets that they may want to acquire and ultimately use as they go into the world of work. It bodes well for Oregon if we see greater numbers of our young people earlier in their lives being able to make discrete and thoughtful choices about not just their career options, but their collegiate options as well, and more importantly, that they're prepared for them. And so this issue of guidance, this issue of support for career, technical training, and collegiate level expressions of interest, if you will, becomes the second body of work. A third one that bears very little need for sort of introduction is specifically around the issue of STEM. And this is a critical one, not only because it suggests that we have a lot of work to do in science and engineering and mathematics and technology, but it also suggests that we have to link the preparation of students for these critical content areas with the world of work. And by the world of work, it's really thought of as being literally global, not necessarily just local, but how do we actually annex, if you will, kids to a global economy, the likes of which they will live out their entire lives in. A critical element of that, then, is how do they get connected to the world of work right here in Oregon? And it begs for partners, it begs for members of the business community, members of the STEM coalition, employers coalition body, and other interested parties to be party to this entire array of initiatives in terms of STEM. I can tell you that there's a number of conversations that people have had, and I certainly subscribe to this notion that this is really as much maybe as a subtext about inclusion of the arts in this, because it is by way of how the brain functions and patterns and designs around making sense of science and analytical work is a design, is a pattern recognition function, and that has a lot to do with math and science. And so we do want to at least give a shout out and a nod to the notion that we ought to be thinking about ways by which not only the brain develops, but ways by which young people make sense out of math and science critically by using the arts. And the last, and certainly not least, of the four is this notion that in order for us to actually have our young people be prepared and have these opportunities, it starts really with a core of highly developed and supported teachers in our classrooms. And I know the board and I, and I believe the governor as well, spoke to this in a number of settings, each of which was designed to basically say out loud, let's call this what it is. This is about teacher development and teacher training. This is not so much just about, if you will, just, you know, the national conversations around teacher accountability. This is really about how do you help people be the best that they can be. And our work in this area is really dedicated to that. It means working much more collaboratively and, frankly, differently with our deans in our colleges of education. It begs for a lot of sponsorship, if you will, and collaboration among ESDs as well as colleges of education. It gives new purpose and, frankly, in some cases, new life to institutions that really sort of saw themselves as sort of fading away from some of this across campus. It's not necessarily just in colleges of education, but it's in the humanities and in the arts as well, so that this is about developing standards, if you will, that are sort of about the entire development of a human being and their, if you will, hard skills as well as soft skills. And critically, it's really about how we want to see the next generation of teachers coming into Oregon and feeling like this is a state where they not only stay beyond the national average, which is about 3 years, but they stay and they deepen their knowledge, they deepen their skill, and they stay with us in Oregon as they do that. And that particularly those who are in the pipeline represent more and more, both by language and by culture and by ethnicity, they represent more and more of the demographics of the students that are in this state. So those areas really represent the kind of framing of the here's what we'd like to be able to do. Obviously, there's much more detail about each one of these as it relates not only to the expenditure of dollars, but about where and who the other partners are as we go forward. But for teeing up a conversation both today and very shortly, the details will be emerging as to how the dollars that the governor has put in the budget would flow. But for today, at least being able to give you a thumbnail sketch of these being the priorities that the organization is now centered upon on a P20 basis, this is a way of being able to at least initiate that conversation. Be happy to answer any additional questions.
I would just chime in, Dr. Crew, about your comment about teacher development, staff development, and so forth, and what a key component that is, and how much, I think, more emphasis and focus needs to be there on a statewide basis. But I would think you would also agree that it's necessary to have a very quality teacher assessment.
Yes.
Process in play in order for anyone to know where that help needs to be directed.
Right.
That first we have to get that tool in play and functioning well, and then we can make those decisions about who needs the help and what type of help that is, because so it can be targeted to the specific needs of that instructor, or that educator, wherever they may be.
Right.
In the P20 continuum.
I would agree.
Right.
I just have a quick question. Welcome again, Dr. Carter.
Thank you very much.
And since we're at the 30,000-foot level, you know, as it were, I just want to ask you, you know, you've been in the state several months now, and what has your impression been of our post-secondary system here in the, you know, in Oregon? You know, what do you notice about it, you know, in the months that you've been here in state?
That's a very good question, actually, and I thank you for it. I notice that there are enormous, let me start on the positive side, enormous, that I think that there are incredible, there's an incredible array of talent that's in the system in the form of its faculty, in the form of the research that's been happening over time. I think that there are any number of individuals whose names I could quote, and basically everyone would know them as having done some seminal work that is both nationally recognized as well as locally extraordinarily recognized and used by a lot of our practitioners. I think that there is a sense of collaboration that exists in some segments of the state, some sectors of the state, and not so much in others. People sort of, the seven universities in my mind are not necessarily always on the dance card, or vice versa of the 17 community colleges, so I think that there's some collaboration, and then other places not as much. My observation about the from a student lens would be that we have large numbers of students, much like in the K-12 system, for whom the system is working, admittedly with a high cost factor, but nonetheless it's working at a reasonably predictably high rate. And then we've got a significant number of people who are not functioning well within it at all. We have far too many students that are coming in from K-12 and ultimately remaining in these developmental low-level classes. And so the cost structure of low performance stays with us through the P20 system, actually, in terms of the numbers of kids who are needing to have additional time or additional coursework, or can't start their collegiate career because they really don't have the requisite skills of being able to do the writing or the reading, mathematics necessary to do so. I do think that there has been a fair amount of fragmentation, if you will, at the post-secondary level that has, in my mind, deteriorated from or reduced, if you will, the kind of maximum qualitative work that could be done in some areas that don't require policy, that seemingly don't require even law, but they just simply require people to get in a room and figure it all out and do it differently. And so my sense is that the areas of greatest strength are the people and the talent that they bring, the wherewithal that they have to stay in the system and to make it one of the top-ranked, both R1 and community college systems in the nation. And yet, on the other hand, the weaknesses undermine that, predictably so, in the sense that the there are people who fundamentally operate in silos, systems who operate in silos, cost structures that reflect those silos, and cost structures that are not amenable to an easy fix without some major sort of political surgery, if you will. And so it brings us to what I think is essentially the right set of questions, some of which no doubt will be the subject of today's conversation, but it brings us right to the right point in time when we get a chance to really see whether or not we're able to cause those systems to be less silo-driven, more student-driven, and to match up with the availability and the access that we want for all kids, or all young people, if you will, in the state of Oregon, and to match up also with the economy and the economic needs of the state of Oregon, so that we are predictably producing far greater numbers of workforce-ready people who can take jobs right here, and frankly would be the beacon of light for economic redevelopment in the state of Oregon. Thank you, sir.
I guess I might ask Dr. Crew, from that 30,000-foot level with the advent of compacts, I've been at some forums in Beaverton lately. Parents are very concerned about, the massive layoffs that occur there of teachers, that what good are some of these compacts and some of these reforms if we don't even have the money? How can we achieve these compacts with 50 kids in a math class? To what extent is that dynamic playing into your observations now that you've been on the ground for 6 months or so?
I think it plays into my observations in a very critical way. Because what we essentially have is what economists like to call a system with a large downside variability, that there is far too high a rate of variation in the outcome. And when you look at why we are producing such a high rate of variance, it's because the system has had major gaps in some elements of it, one being its funding, a second being the whole issue of class size. These gaps in terms of 50 classes of 50, classes of 45, et cetera, do not lend themselves to producing high-performing moments, if you will, high cognitive opportunities or even very good relationships with teachers or between teachers and students, because the numbers just are slightly prohibitive of being able to do that. So when you go back into the machinery of what produces really high outcomes in terms of students who are actually ready and moving on into post-secondary and other kinds of career options, it's fundamentally because they had a great relationship with a teacher, they had a great opportunity to learn something extraordinary in their career, they got turned on to a passionate set of outcomes that they now are committed to, either because they love the learning of it, or they want to apply it in their own occupational pursuit, or their own collegiate pursuit. And that passion, that purpose, comes together because they had a great teacher, and they had an opportunity to be with that teacher, or they had a great guidance person, or they had a great athletic program, or a music program, or a whole set of programs, all of which have fallen prey to many years of underfunding. And I think that is what has played a great deal of havoc on, or wreaked a great deal of havoc on the systems to date. When you hear us talking about the objectives and the outcome, the priorities that we have now, these are priorities that essentially go to strengthen the areas where I see us as being really weak. I think we've got to have greater connectivity between the home and schooling. And schools, rather, with parents, and this is particularly true in communities throughout, but it's particularly true with children whose first language is not English. We've got to have opportunities for students to actually be more literate by third grade. That has a whole lot to do with who's actually going to go to college and who's not, who's going to succeed in college, who's not. The same would be true for our eighth grade, if you will, fifth and eighth grade mathematics standards and ways by which young people are having access to the highest level of mathematics programming and content. That, again, has a lot to do with who's going to be able to take the jobs in STEM, assuming they come to this state and there are in this state. It would be a shame for our kids to actually have been trained in our school systems, but then not be able to take advantage of the economic largesse by virtue of not being adequately prepared you know, pursue these careers and so forth. So I think that these things have to, these are interlocking and frankly interdependent kinds of yin and yang, if you will, bodies of work, and whether it be policy work or whether it's content work or whether it's training of teachers or or whether it's providing opportunities for all young people, regardless of where they are in the educational spectrum, we've just got to do a better job of raising the entire foundation of that. Or otherwise, you know, we're going to just create a new system in which we still leave out significant numbers of people.
Thank you. Should we move on?
Matt, I think you've got an interesting proposal for us or a presentation, so we'll let you tee up.
Okay, well, thank you very much. My name is Matt Donegan, and I serve on the Oregon Education Investment Board. I also serve as chair of its Governance and Policy Committee. I appreciate the opportunity to speak here today. Just by way of background, the recommendation I'm going to walk through was really born out of the last legislative session with 909 and 242. There were a number of pieces that were created and a need to somewhat rationalize those pieces and see how they fit together. So the OEIB did form a governance and policy committee in the fall and tasked us with doing just that, which is really seeing how the pieces should all fit together. This was really a project intended to apply to the overall education enterprise here in Oregon, K-12, community colleges, as well as universities, but really with a specific focus on post-secondary in the short term, just given, again, formation of the HEC, as well as all the work that was being done on institutional boards. So what you're going to see here is a little bit more detail with regard to post-secondary, but again, an architecture that hopefully will apply to the overall education system. So with that, I'll draw your attention to the PowerPoint slide here, which I will, yeah, exactly, wake up.
I was awake. Yeah, I just can't see that far. I'm old.
No, we're going to just come right at you. So
I think there's a portion of white space that didn't get used.
Okay, I deserve that. But I would just say, by comparison, this is actually a fairly simple chart compared to what we're actually dealing with today. I'm going to talk about this very briefly, and then I'm going to talk a little bit more specifically about the recommendations that are embedded in this. Let me just start by drawing your attention to the fact that this is what I would describe as being a horizontal organization chart as opposed to a traditional vertical organization chart where you might see the state on the top on the vertical with the schools on the bottom, you know, connoting kind of a command and control familiar structure. This is more viewed as horizontal and therefore a bit of a partnership. And the partnership between the state on the left, which you'll see up in quotes, the state really providing active strategic investments in leadership. And by that, what that's intended to say is that this is not a passive state that's just simply writing checks for education. And neither is it a really micromanaging role for the state to pretend that it's in the business of delivering education. It's not doing that either. Its role is really focused and defined as being what I would say a value-added investor, which means providing leadership and providing some essential services, things like perhaps some of the teacher development that Dr. Crew just mentioned, also longitudinal database, so providing capital but also other essential services. The schools really being left then to innovate and to be the providers of education on the right. And then the glue between the two sides being this yellow bar in the middle, the achievement compacts, which really establishes this partnership. This is mutuality, mutual expectations, where the state's providing something to this partnership, the schools are providing something else to this partnership, distinct roles, but again, mutuality of expectations. So that's the broad architecture. I'll start with the right side of the chart because I think it's a little bit, it's probably the simplest. The right side of the chart, I think in a nutshell, this is supportive of and assumes The adoption of the legislative concept 759, which I think is next on the agenda. So rather than walking everybody through that once and then repeating or hearing somebody else repeat, I'll just say that this is basically supportive of a legislative process that's occurred over the last several months, with one exception. There is one addition. It's not a difference, but one addition, and that is this does contemplate potentially the formation of what we're calling a shared services enterprise, and that's on the lower right side of the chart. And that is just more or less a placeholder for a better discussion. We just didn't have the time to really drill down on that and figure that out. What that's really intended to say is if you're going to get a board at PSU, you're going to get a board at the University of Oregon, if you're going to somewhat break apart the system as we know it, let's not just devolve into a system or a series of redundant services at the institutional level. Let's take a look at trying to save a buck, improve quality, best practices by establishing a shared services enterprise that would then provide critical back office type services, at least in the universities and potentially to the community colleges. So I would say the business background that I had, this is something that's very common, and so this would be more or less a shared services enterprise where the customers, if you will, would be the institutions. Probably said enough about that, but one last thing I would. The spirit of this would be on an opt-in model. The spirit of this would not be a mandate for those schools, those institutions. Hopefully this would be an opportunity for those schools. There might be some requirements. I mean, I mentioned the longitudinal database. The state might require folks to feed into that longitudinal database and use the shared services enterprise as an example. There might be others. But the basic spirit of the shared services enterprise would be one of opt-in, and maybe even the governance model could even be a co-op, where the actual customers, those institutions on the right, might actually form the board of governance. Again, we just kind of left it there and said that's an opportunity to be explored, and we'll see how the merits present themselves. On the left side of the chart, which is really where I'm going to focus most of the discussion here, you'll see several attributes on the left side of the chart, which is really the state. And the first thing is, again, starting with the legislature and with the governor, really trying to form an apparatus that is responsive to the legislature and to the governor representing the people of Oregon. The OEIB, the Oregon Education Investment Board, then hiring and firing the chief education officer, Dr. Crew being our first CEO. The CEO then having a staff that would include direct reporting relationship to the head of the Department of Education, as well as the head of a newly formed Department of Post-Secondary Education, and then also a direct OEIB staff that would then really be providing a lot of the cross functions to the Department of Education and Post-Secondary. Early learning in K-12 residing within the Department of Education. And then use a little bit of color coding on this slide to suggest that the ELC, the Early Learning Council, the OSEC, the Oregon State Education Council or Commission, and the HEC would essentially be aligned with the OEIB. I mean, we're envisioning something akin to almost a subcommittee structure to be really fleshed out. But the idea is we don't want these groups acting in a disparate manner. We want to have alignment and perhaps even crossover membership, again, with more specificity to be built out. With that broad architecture, I'll talk a little bit about what some of the objectives. And there were guiding principles. There were principles handed to this group that we were intending to honor. But in terms of really strategic objectives that we were trying to achieve in our organization, these were the seven that we identified. Number one was scaling up P20. I mean, in a nutshell, I think what the OEIB is all about is really trying to achieve P20 integration, collaboration. The second one is to provide much more strategic focus on our state investments in education. Number three, which will be spoken to in a moment with regard to the university governance, was really to position universities to be much more attractive for philanthropy and for private investment, while at the same time protecting the sacred public mission. Objective number four, which is related to number three, is to really provide the institutions on the right with the flexibility for innovation that they need to succeed. Number five, increase the effectiveness of critical state functions. Six would be maximizing value to students. This again speaks to the shared services enterprise. And the number seven, streamline. We've heard that loud and clear from the legislature. Too many commissions, too many reporting structures, and so there's a real desire to try to streamline. Just walk through what we've done here. In terms of the first objective, scaling up P20 integration, how we seek to achieve that, number one, connecting the early learning and K-12 state functions with the Oregon Department of Ed. Number two, connect community colleges and university functions within the post-secondary education department. Number three would then be to build a connectivity between K-12 and post-secondary, and those critical 10 to 14 with heavy involvement from the HEC. Number four, the OEIB staff under Dr. Crew would really be organized by function that would then cut across the silos. Number five, co-located responsibility for post-secondary education allocation formulas, and then number six would be to share staff. So again, these are, why are we doing all this? I think a big reason why we're doing all this really is to build out the P20. And so these are some very specific recommendations on how to do that.
Mr. Chair, can I just ask, Matt, yes. Could you just clarify, could you go back to the previous slide? What exactly do you mean by co-locate responsibility?
Ask, actually, Ben, do you mind setting up?
For your record, Ben Cannon, Education Policy Advisor to the Governor. The question was about number five here on co-locating responsibility for post-secondary funding allocation formulas. As you know, today, the Board of Education is responsible for allocating the legislative appropriation to community colleges, to those community colleges. It holds, if you will, the formula for that. The Board of Higher Education makes a similar kind of allocation decision with respect to the universities, the seven universities. And the Oregon Student Access Commission allocates Oregon Opportunity Grants to Oregon students. The proposal here is that that responsibility should be held in one place, and that a student or a family or an Oregonian would have a single place to go to lobby their case, make their case for how the state's investment in post-secondary education can be most effectively utilized in order to secure access, opportunity, affordability, and outcomes for Oregonians.
That's all I needed to know. Thank you.
Sure. I'll press the buttons.
Yeah, if you would. Second objective, enable statewide strategic investments. This is obviously related to the last question, but shift post-secondary funding formulas to the Department of Post-Secondary Education and the HEC. Number two is coordinate appropriations and need-based aid functions within the Department of Post-Secondary Education. And number three would really be to charge the OEIB staff to integrate P20 investment recommendations to the full OEIB based upon a return on investment. And that return on investment should not be interpreted to be a strictly financial measure, but rather a broader, more holistic measure of how the state views return on investment, including issues like access and issues like diversity and beyond just simply economic objectives. Number three, position universities to increase private investment. This is going to be addressed later on in the agenda, but we just basically took it that we would adopt legislative concept 759. Objective four, increase flexibility for innovation by education institutions, very critically looking to maintain the local autonomy and governance for K-12 community colleges, and add to that local boards for the University of Oregon and PSU. and then establish a single governing board for the remaining five OUS schools with a new board that would be focused on university governance, as opposed to what is the current focus of the Board of Higher Education, much more program approvals and funding and so forth. Number five, I'm not going to really rattle through these. This is basically saying, though, that the OEIB has a number of critical state functions that it needs to build out. This is clearly a startup organization, and that this would envision that you would build out these state functions, such as the longitudinal database, such as building the P20 pathways. So there's a lot of work left to be done. We've had a good start with the OEIB, but there's clearly a lot of capacity building left ahead. Number six, maximize value to students. Again, the shared services enterprise would be something that we would like to scope as an opportunity to continue to drive value, lower costs, and improve quality. Again, with emphasis on an opt-in as appropriate, and potentially a co-op governance structure. And then finally, streamlined and aligned commissions. We do envision merging the HEC and OSAC, consolidating state post-secondary agencies, and really establishing OEIB as ultimately responsible for the state education leadership, aligned with what I'm just calling sub-councils, not perhaps literally sub-councils, but I think the notion is that the spirit of this would be in alignment with crossover membership, again, to be built with the details to be built out. So that's a mouthful. It's a recommendation that has some specificity at this point, but other placeholders for further work to be done with the shared services enterprise, for instance. And I should have mentioned that this recommendation was approved yesterday at the OEIB meeting. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Logistically, how do you see this going through the next session? There's obviously some budget ramifications and language considerations.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, chairs. As you know, the governor's recommended budget anticipates the creation of a Department of Post-Secondary Education, and so we're working with our staff at the Office of Budget and Management on the appropriations bills that would effectively achieve that particular objective. The sort of broader questions of governance authorities and boards and commissions, we intend very much, now that we have secured OEIB's kind of endorsement for this work, to work through. I mean, the focus for the work clearly becomes legislature and legislative committees, and our intent would be to work between now and the legislative session, and then into the session with legislators and legislative committees to put this together in a way that's consistent with the OEIB and the governor's priorities and also yours. So I think that's likely on our part to mean engaging some or many of you individually, and then perhaps establishing a kind of work group structure that would help us get from here to there. But obviously, this has a lot to do with the interests and priorities of the members and the direction that you all are intending to head. This may be useful to you as you pursue your own approaches to this. We hope this expresses kind of where the governor intends to go, but without, you know, leaving a lot of room for continued conversation with you around how to fill in these details.
Senator Byrd.
Well, my congratulations to you. I think you've done the near impossible, which is making some sense out of the structure that we've kind of brought out of the last sessions. At least conceptually, I think it makes a lot of sense. It adds for a reasonable starting and ending place. It allows for more accountability. So I think you've done a good job on that. Obviously, there's a whole lot between the concept and implementation and a lot of work ahead. The one thing that I like the model on the potential that the shared enterprise system, I will tell you that a number of my school districts, or the smaller ones, are expressing a lot of fear about that. Their fear is that they might lose their business manager and and through doing that lose their ability to strategically manage their operations. So I like the idea that you're looking at it as a voluntary basis. Yeah. Co-op model, if you pull that off, makes a lot of sense, so they have a buy-in. But I think that one's worth pursuing. I think there's a lot of potentials, as Dr. Crewe knows. There are a lot of other states that have done that. Kansas stands in mind, that saved a lot of money and redirected some administrative dollars back into the classroom. But I think we need to be cautious and let people come along rather than being dragged along.
Great guidance.
Yeah, Matt, I certainly want to appreciate your, or just thank you for your service. You've been a busy guy for the last several months. I mean, your performance or your sharing at the business summit last week, a couple weeks ago, was great, very well received. But my concerns, I think, are similar to Senator Byers on the shared services piece. You know, it's difficult for me to imagine all this coming together without somehow that being in place, because I think there are going to be almost immediate needs for that, as assuming the passage of the governance bill that we'll be introducing and so forth. That component is going to be key, because, you know, that pulling out those two larger entities is going to leave a void in that system. So I don't know if there's some kind of a way we can talk about a phase in, a staging of this or whatever, but it just seems we need to be thinking, I think, real practically about that, because obviously that's going to be a real concern. And one of our tenets of the original draft, of course, was, you know, in the governance, was to make sure that whatever we did wasn't going to compromise or have a harmful effect on those who wouldn't be a part of that initial independence, if you will. So we definitely have some work to do there. And Representative Hunt.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ben, if you could actually go back, it was the slide that had the whole org chart side by side on it. I think you've really made a very effective case because of the commitment to P20 and the commitment to, well, even 40-40-20, and what you referred to as the Connect 10 to 14, trying to better bridge that somewhat artificial gap we have in the system right now. Well, I'd agree with Senator Byer that this makes far more sense than what we have right now. I wonder if you could just share with us, did you look at even potentially collapsing it one more level, especially at that level where you've got the ELC, Department of Ed, OSEC, Department of Postsecondary Education, to even better try and recognize and implement that reality of integration across them? And if you did talk about that, maybe just talk about why you didn't come out there.
I would say, Representative Hunt, it's a great question, and I think it's a natural question, and I think our committee expected that would be a natural issue to be explored further by the legislature. So I wouldn't say that we came down hard against further integration. You probably could argue this is a bit flatter. This does provide a direct reporting relationship between the Department of Post-Secondary Education to Dr. Crewe. That would probably be its primary virtue. I think the advantages that you just described for their integration deserve further consideration.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just, you know, to that point, Matt, I was going to comment on this, so I'm glad that you brought that up, Rep. Hunt. You know, whenever it was, a decade ago, when we started the Senate Bill 242 process, you know, we had national experts come in who were advising us as we were going down that road, and there was, you know, at that time, the initial conversation about perhaps a P20 board, an overarching board for the entire education continuum. And the experts that we heard from, who were experts in post-secondary, really cautioned us against adopting such a structure in Oregon. But they said that if you are going to have such a structure in Oregon, you need to have a strong advocacy piece for post-secondary, because, you know, in their observation, if they, when they see P20 boards across the country, the K-12 issues tend to totally dominate the conversation, and very little attention is paid to the post-secondary. And it was that advice, actually, that led to the conception of the HEC, the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission, whose chair, by the way, is here, Betty Duvall, in the audience. Welcome, Betty. And, you know, in order to, you know, really focus on the post-secondary issues within the larger framework of P20. And so, you know, I think at least as a, you know, in the short term, I think this structure makes a lot of sense. I want to say personally, I really applaud the, you know, the bringing together of community colleges and universities and mm-hmm. the Student Access Commission into one piece. And another that we haven't talked about is the Office of Degree Authorization and the entity that's really going to guarantee that we have an articulated system, you know, in community colleges and universities, et cetera, that, you know, that there is, we're looking at curriculum in a coordinated manner and research in a coordinated manner, that, you know, et cetera. I think that's really going to be important. You know, Rep. Johnson used the term staged, you know, thinking of this in terms of a staged process as it plays out over, you know, the next few years. And I think we really do want to think of it in those terms. But, you know, having said that, you know, I think that this framework really does make sense to me. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So first of all, I'm excited about anything that cuts down barriers between things and starts to think about things along continua. And so the way you've articulated it in the objectives piece of this, I think, does a very good job of laying out how you're thinking about how there would be integration among all these different entities, faculty development, for example, along the entire continuum, where there are some similarities and some differences. Recognizing that this isn't entirely within your bailiwick, what the governor has proposed, if I remember correctly, is a Department of Postsecondary Education and Workforce Development. And I'm interested in your understanding of where workforce development would fit into this diagram, if you're willing to comment on that.
Yeah, sure. Senator Steiner Hayward.
It's the problem, you have the longest name in the legislature.
and shares. So there have been discussions about that. What is anticipated in the governor's budget and in this proposal is a Department of Postsecondary Education and Workforce Development. So it migrates the existing Community College and Workforce Development Department to this new department. There is, however, you know, an additional conversation about the future role of workforce, connections to, perhaps greater connections to the Department of Employment and other places where workforce is housed in our state infrastructure. The Oregon Workforce Investment Board will be receiving recommendations, I believe, this week, or making recommendations this week, that sort of speak to the evolving nature of that conversation. So I would say this is not an entirely settled question, that this org chart that does anticipate including workforce may be a step on the way towards a further evolved system that has workforce really more integrated, whether it's within this department or somewhere else in state government. So that is an important and, frankly, unresolved question, and one that's been bouncing around in Oregon for quite a while as workforce continues to look for a sort of permanent home.
May I ask a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Certainly.
Thank you. So I had the privilege of serving under Representative Harker on the STEM Access Task Force, which some of you will be hearing about at 3 o'clock. And one of the conversations that we had repeatedly among the very, very bright people who served on that task force was about the importance of, on the one hand, not overemphasizing the role of industry and workforce development education, but not underemphasizing it either. And as we think about maintaining, developing a robust, sustainable economy in Oregon, we have to ensure that as we try to grow businesses that already exist and expand businesses that we hope to attract to our state or initiate in our state, that we have the workforce they need so that Oregonians can get good jobs here and businesses aren't required to import workers. So personally, the more we can do to integrate this, because education should not be simply for the sake of developing a good workforce. There are a lot of other good reasons to provide robust education at every stage of life. But workforce development is part of lifelong learning. And as we think about this in that context, I personally would express my support for a very comprehensive, smooth integration between the two areas.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Matt, one other question for you. Obviously, you know one of the objectives behind Senate Bill 242 was to help the OUS, take the OUS system off of being a state agency and so forth, to give them the ability to operate a little more efficiently and find economies of scale and so forth and so on. But are we taking a step back now by putting them into a newly created state agency or department, if you will? And is it going to compromise their ability to truly be innovative and to look for ways that they can provide the best access and affordability?
I think that's an excellent question. I should say that the OUS on the right side of the chart here is envisioned to continue with 242 as an independent non-state agency status. There are some functions that would come out of that that would then migrate over to the Department of Post-Secondary Education. But mm-hmm. I think that the critical functions that were really intended in 242 would reside over on the right side of the chart. Is that?
The proof will be in the pudding, obviously, but yeah.
I agree.
Yeah. Thanks.
Well, you guys need to move to your next venue?
Are you going to do the recommendations from the...
All right. We've got to do that first.
30 seconds to do the update. We'll dismiss our panel.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, gentlemen. I think everybody in this committee, I think all legislators were given a copy of the final draft of the University Governance Task Force. And essentially, what the task force did, and it passed unanimously, was set up the framework for providing sort of hybrid university boards at Portland State and the University of Oregon. And while there was agreement on the parameters of that bill, there's still some technical details that will need to be filled in the legislature. And so without going into a lot of those details here, that's essentially the update. If mm-hmm. my colleagues want to add anything.
Well, it would be our intent later during our House portion of the meeting today to actually introduce a slate of committee bills, and that legislation will be one of those committee bills that we take on our plate on the House side. Senator Byers?
It's probably worth noting that while it specifically recognizes PSU and U of O, it also sets out the parameters for the other universities if they choose to move forward with institutional boards.
Right. Good point. Next, you want to add?
Yeah, just, I'd like to say, first of all, that, there's been some reference to the previous LC. We actually have a new LC number. So if you're looking to see the actual bill, it's now LC 978, and it's on our exhibits website. The version that we adopted, when we made our recommendations back in October, is about 10 pages long. And now I'm happy to report it's 169 pages long. and that's how we do things here in the legislature.
It's a more weighty bill.
But I just want to caution you that really the part that you need to read is still the first 10 pages. What comes after that is what's called conforming language, because there are, things, the statute changes, and all of those changes have to be reflected. The part that's of substance is in the opening section. And as you look at it, and there's going to be a lot of work on this, through the next session. I'd encourage you to look at the opening principles that we adopted, that lay out what we're looking for as we try to fill in the framework for this bill. I mean, it's hard to believe, 169 pages, and it's just a framework. But that is, that is what it is. But it's going to be guided by these core principles. And those principles, ultimately, we want to find that sweet spot where institutions can get the benefits of having local boards close to home, but at the same time, the benefits of having an articulated system are maintained.
And those principles will help us as we do that work. You know, I think that we're committed in the legislature to really making this a very open process, a very public process, as we work through and try to answer those questions. And we're going to really be encouraging a lot of citizen input throughout this process.
Okay. Well said. So with that, the Senate side will recess and go next door. Before I do that, I just want to say thank you so much to our counterparts in the House. This committee, the Senate Education Committee and the House Higher Ed Committee, has worked pretty well in the past session and interim, and I very much appreciate that, especially the two co-chairs. And to all of you, your work will live on here, even though I know some of you are going on to bigger and better things. Probably won't have this configuration of individuals together ever again, so I just thank you all. And with that, we'll recess and go to room B.
We stay open, right?
You can stay open.
All right.
You want to sit, Victoria, you want to sit here now? No, they're next door. Okay.
We'll keep our hearing open, House members. And we'll prepare for a recommendation from the STEM Task Force. We'll be next on our agenda, so whoever's participating in that, if you want to prepare for that, we'll get ready. I think let's dive in. We're here. There you go. Get your other fruit.
A couple of other people in the hallway.
Take your time. Didn't get that thing Matthew's had. He's always seen this. I think Sean created actually. Yeah, he's writing some really good. Here today, but he's missed all week. It's not like it.
Yeah.
Good to see her.
Sir.
Likewise. How
you
been?
You again.
Busy.
Okay.
How you doing?
See you again, sir.
Nice to see you. We'll convene our little group back together again and get back on track. We're going to have a presentation from the STEM Task Force, going to be their recommendations, and just remind the committee that the our House Higher Ed Committee in February passed a committee bill that called for the creation of the STEM Task Force. So what we're hearing now is what was instituted in that legislation, received this report. So we look forward to hearing what you have to share. So Representative Harker, I'll turn it over to you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members, for the record, I am Chris Harker, currently the representative from House District 34, which is Beaverton and Cedar Hills area. Thanks so much. I am, with your permission, going to read a little bit from the executive summary of the report, because I think it sets the tone well for what we're going to tell you about today. Here I go. Oregon's role in the global economy is defined by its citizens' flexibility to respond to an ever-changing employment climate. Being competitive in the global market means that citizens are literate in the sciences, technologies, engineering, and mathematics, the STEM disciplines. And I'll step out of reading mode here to say this sounds awfully familiar to some of what we were just hearing from Dr. Crew and others. And I think there's good integration with what's happening on their efforts, with their efforts and with what we're proposing here. Back to the executive summary. Our high school, community college, and higher education students are not receiving the support they need to pursue advanced STEM education. The task force believes there's not a brain to waste in Oregon and so proposes a pipeline of resources that will engage P20 students, teachers, industry partners, and the community as a whole to build and support STEM learning in Oregon. Now is the hour. Oregon must get serious about investing in STEM. As you said, Chair Johnson, House Bill 4056 last time around authorized this task force and with the governor's office helped put together a wonderful selection of people from all different disciplines related to STEM. We had students at the high school level, college level, teachers, members of ODE, after school providers, higher ed and industry, as well as two representatives and two senators. We had four full task force meetings and more than 20 meetings of the five work groups that were created within the task force to focus on different areas. We tried to produce a readable report. We have tremendous amount of detail in the appendices, but we tried to produce a report knowing that there's a vast amount of paper appearing on your desks or PDFs on your laptops, and so we wanted to produce, and I think we did produce, something that could be read and gleaned from without too much of a burden. We consolidated what each work group brought into a report that everyone could get behind, and we're asking for three big things, really. We're asking to create a STEM council. We're asking to create some hubs and programs that would be coordinated by these council, and we're asking the state to make some improvements to infrastructure and the education that it affords around the state. We have in this state a number of employers of various sizes, from quite small to quite large, who are all in the STEM area. There is a tremendous recognition across those employers of the need for the educational system in this state to produce people who are well-trained and well-versed in those disciplines, and that we are not currently producing enough of those people to fill the occupations that the employers have to offer. And that's a shame in a state with the unemployment rate that we have here, right? I'm going to turn this over to some of the task force members to give perspectives on the situation from their particular vantage point. But before I do so, I want to say one more thing. That is, in Appendix B, we have a little blurb at the end about STEAM, the incorporation of arts into STEM. All right? While STEM education is the main focus of this task force and its report, the task force also advocates for the role of art education in developing competent STEAM graduates. And by incorporating the arts into STEM and producing STEAM education, we really feel that students will have the foundation to excel in their jobs and become the creative problem solvers and well-rounded professionals that the state needs for a vibrant economy. With your permission, then, I will come up to my appointed seat over there and let these women and then two men also fill in, and we'll take questions as they come, okay?
Thank
Anything
you.
For me before I move up there?
Take it away.
Okie dokie.
Well, thank you so much, especially to this committee and to co-chairs Johnson and Dembro, who made this task force possible in the last session, who did the legislative concept and the bill, House Bill 4056. And it's been an absolute fantastic fast journey working with a group of folks. And what I'm going to give you is kind of the 30,000 up view. I'm sorry, my name's Deb Mumhill. I'm the executive director for the Pacific Northwest for FIRST. Most of you guys know us as Oregon First Robotics. So I'm going to give you the 30,000 up top view really quickly of kind of what we're looking at nationally, how Oregon falls into that, and then take you through where our task force has kind of come to this point in time. So, and some of you have seen some of these fantastic slide decks that Eco Northwest provided for a number of folks on the STEM Employer Coalition. So, it's a national problem in STEM. You know, we have a leaky pipeline right now, and when you look at this slide and you see how many ninth graders were in the system and how many came out at the other end, basically you're going to see nationally about 4% of our American students are pursuing STEM degrees, whether they're two-year or four-year degrees. But yet, our Congress knows, President Obama, Secretary of Education Arne Duncan know, that the nation that has the strongest STEM workforce will absolutely become the global leader in the world. And so it's become a national priority for our country to really focus on STEM, and we're thrilled to see the Oregon legislature and the Oregon OEIB also putting a focus on STEM. The next slide is going to kind of show you a little bit of a slide in the Oregon class of 2006 of the 10th graders who took the OAKS test, who eventually graduated from high school, and it takes you all the way down to the 923 who received a STEM degree by 2011. And so when you do your math on that one, you're going to see we fell to 2%. So the nation's at 4%. Oregon's at 2%. We're about 50% behind them. So we have some work and some focus to do in this state to catch up nationally. And then, of course, we would love to be in that 10 to 11, 12% range. This slide basically speaks to the, you know, some of the reasons that we looked at as our task force, not that we have the answers to know why students are not excelling in STEM, why they're possibly not choosing to go into STEM degrees or STEM careers, but it will show you right now that our top 14, of our top 14% math and science students, less than 2% make it to that end point. And we have some ideas on why that is and where the foundational lack of skills is coming from, and also the awareness with families and students about what is STEM and what are those jobs that are out there. This is a national slide of data showing you where we were in 1973 compared to what type of jobs required a high school diploma, a two-year diploma, or a four and above. And you're going to see where it's going to align with our 40-40-20. So nationally, they're projecting 33% of the jobs will need a bachelor's and above, 29% a two-year or a certification, and 38% high school or less. And then you'll get to see where we are, where we've been in Oregon, and where we are going on the 40-40-20 goal. And we think that the task force thinks it's a great goal, but we also kind of approached it going, what are those 40% of those degrees in higher, in four-year degrees, and those 40% in those two-year certification programs, what are they going to be in? And we took it upon ourselves to think about, you know, if we can pull the job, instead of pushing students through the system saying, you know, do your math, do your science, kind of on a push mode where we've been, but to put it onto a pull mode where what are the jobs? What are the jobs in Oregon? What, you know, how do they align to education? And so when you hit those higher ed pathways, you're going to have an idea if you want to go into healthcare, if you want to go into technology, if you want to go into engineering, what your passions are, if you want to go into digital design, and then help them think through that. So we're really hoping that jobs will be a bit of a driver in that. And Senator Steiner Hayward alluded to that in her comments as well, that we have to have that workforce piece making the pull. And that's a big lift, because it's helping the parents and the students understand jobs that didn't exist probably when the parents were back in college, you know, network analyst, cloud computing software analyst, jobs that are of this century that are in those STEM fields, but yet we don't know about them unless we're in that that arena. And then also, how do we help the teachers and the educators who have spent their lifetime in the classroom understand the jobs of the 21st century? So those are things that we talked extensively in our task force about. So nationally, this is a national stat. So for every unemployed person currently in the United States, there is 1.7 jobs in STEM for them, compared to the 4.3 unemployed people who are waiting in line for the one non-STEM job. So our goals as a task force, and hopefully that we can carry through in the state, is to put as many Oregon students into that left side of this chart so that they'll be first in line for the STEM jobs that are out there. We look at OIT, which opened their new campus. It's Oregon Institute of Technology, recently renamed as Oregon Tech. They placed 96% of their graduating class with an average starting salary of $56,000. My son graduated in 2009 from Wilsonville. He has seven Oregon colleagues with him at his school in Boston. The average starting salary for them, and a lot of them are doing electrical computing engineering, $88,700 last year. So the salaries are phenomenal. And if you look at those students that are out in Boston getting that degree, the top employers were Microsoft, Amazon, Google, Apple, and Tesla. And when you think about that, those are all companies whose headquarters are less than 200 miles from our borders, yet they also have little branch offices and facilities that they're starting to build out here. So you can kind of see where that connection's going to form. If we can have a workforce that's qualified in STEM, we should be able to attract more businesses here. The next slide is a 2008 Oregon education kind of slide that shows you projecting out how many of the STEM careers are going to require a bachelor's or associate's degree. And you'll see 29% will be in a certification or two-year program, 43% in bachelor's, and 17% when you add the five in doctoral, 22% in higher education. And on average, the STEM jobs nationally pay 25% more than the non-STEM occupations. This is going to show you, if we do an investment today, this slide will kind of allude to that we can increase our personal income by $9 billion if we can bring the STEM jobs into Oregon and have Oregonians working in those, and Oregonian natives working in those jobs, and that the annual per capita personal income is going to raise. So what that translates to is another $1.4 billion increase in our state and local government general tax and fee revenues, which would then translate to $389 million increase in our general fund through revenue. So we talked a little, Representative Harker, who is our wonderful chairman of this committee, talked about the national priority, how there's many White House initiatives out there. Bipartisan and bicameral support for the issue in Congress, they all get that STEM needs to be propped up in our country. Many grant solicitations now require STEM. The 21st Century Community Learning Centers, which is a lot of our after-school programs and money for Title I, are putting an absolute targeted focus on STEM. And then there's a big business interest in STEM, both nationally and regionally here in the state. And so our recommendations, again, are in front of you, but it talks about the STEM Council, the STEM Hubs, some funding to support the STEM students and programs, to bump up proper technology infrastructure. A lot of that was about broadband use. A lot of these amazing programs in STEM are out on the cloud, but if we don't have broadband that can bring them into the classrooms, that's an issue. And then the pathway piece. So there's a lot of ways that we could set this up. Our committee didn't have time to really delve into this, but this is just an example of an idea of what a hub would look like. I think the GTE out in Hood River and the Dalles, the Gorge Technology Alliance, is a prime organic example of what we're going after, where families can be involved, local industries can have a voice, that the P-20 system will be right there with them, and there's a delivery of programs. And so it's bringing all of that together in these regional hubs is something that we're proposing from this committee to go forward with. And so we have a few more people who are going to speak to you about that. Next up is Savannah Lohberger, who is from Hillsborough High School, to share her experience and her ideas for what we need to do.
Thank you. I'd like to thank co-chairs Johnson and Dembro. And my name is Savannah Lohberger, and I'm from Hillsborough High School. I'd like to thank you for this opportunity. It was quite an experience serving on the task force, and definitely a new experience, but a positive one for sure. As I said from the beginning, though, I really hope that this is, well, to put straightforward, not a waste of time. I would really like to see something come out from this, and I would really like to see some action, being in the trenches every day, as it said. A typical day in my school is my average class size is 38 kids. And so our class periods are 90 minutes long. And this means I get 2.3 minutes with my teacher every day, which I also shared at the Oregon Business Leadership Summit. And I think that this needs to change. And how, if you want to reach the kids, you got to do more than just in the classroom. And they also need out-of-school time. One of the reasons I am here today and able to speak with you is because I have had adult interaction through the eChamp program and through FIRST program, in FIRST LEGO League, FIRST Tech Challenge, and I had the adult interaction, and I've had experiences that have prepared me and encouraged me to go into a STEM career. And being, even with that, I've had support to even start my own program to reach other kids. It's called Girls Get It, and I was kind of tired of being the only girl in my engineering class and on my robotics team, so I started an all-girls engineering and technology summer program where girls can experience STEM or STEAM in a fun and positive way that kids really need to have in order to see STEM as a possibility for them and in a career, and that's what we want. I support the STEM, the idea of a STEM council, STEM hubs and programs, and the improvements to infrastructure and education. And I think that the task force, the report is spot on, and thank you.
Thank you.
We have Terrell Smith and Eric Meslow also are going to come up and join on the panel, and I'll scooch down one.
Madam Chair, can
question?
Mr. Chair.
Comment?
No question. I just want to comment, having been at the business summit that so many of us were, that this young lady was the hit of the day, certainly for me.
She was.
Thank you.
Very well received.
Proud.
Yeah. We'll call you back up, Dave.
Mm-hmm.
Good job. Go ahead, Terrell. Co-chairs and members, my name is Terrell Smith. I'm a teacher at Sherwood High School, full-time teacher, and while I wear other hats, I'm just a teacher. One of my jobs is to try to create curriculum that gets kids up in the morning. And, you know, with some funding challenges that we've faced in the recent years, it seems more difficult all the time to create a really interesting curriculum that kids can thrive in, and what I do as a computer science teacher is try to provide that and provide reasons for them to or the opportunity for them to apply what they're learning in, say, the math and science courses in computer science, and then ultimately lead to careers in that area as well. So I was hearing Deb talk about her son and potential salary, and I thought at that moment, scratched my head a little bit and wondered about me being a computer science teacher and opportunities maybe I missed. But then I thought, no, absolutely not. I am called to be a teacher, and I am in a curriculum that I enjoy, but my calling is to teach and to help get those kids up in the morning and to give them a real curriculum that will help launch that and help fill the pipeline with students who deserve to be there. Social justice requires us as adults and those in charge of our emerging humans to give them opportunities, and not just to all, but to the underrepresented, the girls and others of race. Savannah is a great example of that success. We also have a course at Sherwood High School for girls only, engineering course. And we thought maybe we could grab 30 girls, put them in a class, and let them thrive alone without even being bugged by boys. And it turned out that we had 140 girls sign up for the first year. CBS came out and did a little two-minute blurb on it. You may have seen it, but it is a success, and we are doing it again. That is the way you find model programs. That is the way to fill the pipeline, to scratch the itch of social justice and provide opportunities for those we care about to have opportunities that maybe they wouldn't have seen without our tutelage. Okay. What I came for. Dual credit. Successes and failures. Successes for dual credit for kids that are in my classes and others that can get college credit, that it provides a natural flow into our higher ed system. It provides a curriculum connection between high school and college. It provides a career readiness and awareness of my students at what's out there and what's coming up. And again, I come back to it fills the pipeline. But Austin came by the other day, and Austin says, "Now, T. Smith, I'm back from college, and can I help you out? I got a couple hours." And I said, "Sure, Austin. You know, you were great here. You really helped me a lot, and maybe you can work with some of my students while I'm busy over here." And I said, "How are your classes going?" He says, "Oh, they're just really easy. In fact, the one class I'm taking, I learned it all from you last year. So, you know, it's a light class, and I'm taking it. And that's where I failed to provide that dual credit for him and let him move on. So." It's not perfect yet, but the theory is there, and it needs to be streamlined, and more students need to have those opportunities. A few of my colleagues a few years back, thought that they could maybe bring in some of the other curricular areas, and why not write about computer science? Why not read about it? Why not do a cross-curricular project? And so, in Sherwood, we have, and in Oregon, we have rivers, and some of them have fish. And so what's cool about that is that that's our culture. And the English and writing teachers said, you know what, let's involve the engineering department and let's put together a project. And the end game is that students in a writing class read about, and in a reading class read about fly fishing in Montana. They designed a drift boat. They wrote about the design process of building that drift boat. And they actually then built the drift boat in teams, wrote about that as well. The end game was they put that drift boat in the Clackamas River, guided by a former Sherwood High School student. I'm not sure they caught any fish, but, you know, the issue was not catching fish. The issue was the experience. And the STEM programs, the elements that you see in this project, help us do those things that get kids up in the morning. I'll share one other project with you. I have the students I teach play games. So why not tap into that energy? And so we design video games. And one project we're doing right now, we're in the middle of it. We have a game contest in Savannah, indicated earlier, a game programming contest in May. I have kids building a game similar to, World of Warcraft, for example, or ones that I tell them not to play in class. But if you write those games, you can play them. And so they're building an environment, and we're using the engineering 3D printer to they built the characters in another class. We printed them in a 3D printer in an engineering class. We have the music department that are doing computer music background for the game, and they are saying, "T. Smith, man, I got it. I'm actually using my Algebra 2 math right here because we're designing, we have a 3D environment we're designing, we're having to program that in." And the excitement that I see is why I get up in the morning.
Co-Chair Dembro, Co-Chair Johnson, and the committee, thank you very much. My name is Eric Meslow. I'm the President and CEO of TimberCon, Inc. in Tualatin, Oregon. My residence is also in Tualatin. I'm here today wearing a couple different hats, member of the task force. I'm also the current chair of ETIC, the Engineering Technology Industry Council, as well as the co-chair with Jill Island of Intel Corporation of the STEM Employers Coalition, a group of about 40 employers who have made it a priority this coming session to stress this issue and to look for some reforms. I'm here today to represent employers. For me, personally, my passion has always been around the higher education side of effort. That's not because I don't have two girls in the K-12 system that I'm passionate about. It's because as a business owner, I have to be closest to the source of my needs. And my needs, frankly, are four-year degreed STEM graduates and two-year degreed STEM graduates or professional certificate STEM graduates. So I'm going to talk a little bit today about that need. One of my responsibilities as these in these positions is to speak with employers. And I am struck every time I go around the state and talk to employers about their lack of ability to find open positions, which is obviously very disheartening when we can't find positions for our native Oregonians. Instead, many corporations and companies are forced to go out of state. This puts Oregon in a position of being a parasitic state educationally to go out and find these folks. Some numbers that came out of the Oregon Employment Department show over the next 10 years about 40,000 open positions within STEM. And that's a very narrow definition of STEM. It excludes healthcare occupations, excludes any of the social sciences, and excludes any education. It's the tough, tight definition of STEM. Almost 60% of those positions are for graying workforce replacement. You have companies like BPA, PGE, Boeing, Intel, Tektronix, et cetera, that their average age of their workers are in the 50s. This is a huge problem because we are not producing enough STEM graduates in Oregon just to replace those that are retiring. Add to that increased forecast for demand of another 14,000 new positions, you find Oregon in an intolerable position, and companies either leaving the state or being forced to spend extra amounts of resources in bringing people into the state. This is a relatively bleak picture, but a picture that I think is changeable with some focus and some concentration on this issue. That's what worries me most, and that goes back to what Savannah said. This issue has been studied and reported on since the 60s. Every decade, there are reports saying that the United States needs to focus on STEM. In the 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and in the early 2000s, it's been relatively clear on what we need to do. And in every time, we basically admire the problem. And it's time to stop admiring the problem. And that was the conversation that occurred last winter with Representative Johnson, Representative Dembro, as well as the conversation I had with Jill Island of Intel Corporation to try to do something to change that focus. And that is the seed to the STEM Employers Coalition. It's time for the employers of this state to step up and make it a priority, and I believe that they will do so in this next session, so much so we already have a legislative concept, Concept 2288, I believe, that will be coming forth in January and February that will specifically set up a different funding model to start the process of real educational reform around the area of STEM through the K-20 realm. Obviously, this is the higher education piece of that. And for that reason, I want to emphasize that the university system, the four-year degree schools, have been actively doing this, at least in the engineering and technology side of things, with ETIC over the years. However, the S and the M have not been brought to the forefront, and I believe that is necessary at that level. But more importantly to me is the lack of any sort of coordination at the community college level. So many of today's jobs require 13th and 14th grade to be successful, and I believe that we have to have a real emphasis in that regard moving forward. So it's taking some of the best practices that we've come up with over the years. I believe it's important to apply those across the spectrum and start making a real change.
Great, good report. Thank you all. Representative Hunt.
Could I ask, Mr. Chair, could you just say maybe a sentence or two more about that legislative concept? I got the general gist, but
absolutely.
Another step or two.
What we're proposing is something, if you're familiar with ETIC, and a council made up of folks appointed by the chief education officer, the governor's office, to figure out the priorities around STEM at all levels, and then to ultimately fund through a competitive RFP process, very similar to ETIC, programs that can be then measured for success. And if those programs are successful in moving the dial and causing change to occur within the organizations, collaboration at all levels, the output of work-ready graduates, et cetera, then those types of programs should move forward with additional funding in the future and have them replicated throughout the state. If those programs ultimately are not successful, they should go away, as opposed to becoming part of the everyday lexicon of the system. It's what ETIC has done over the years. We've, through both ETIC activities at the university level and also through OPAS down at the K-12 level, where we've been able to try and experiment and figure out some basic best practices and how to change how the system works. And so we're looking for... Initially, the ask was for $50 million in regards to making these changes. Realistically, we understand what we're up against in this next session in regards to funding, and we'll be working with the governor and the legislature and figuring out what that number might be.
If I could just follow up on that, one area I would encourage you all to look at, especially since you're representing employers, it's a really logical tie. As the legislature now... And it won't be done by this committee, but there is another committee out there that will be looking at tax expenditures. And we now have a regular process of reviewing tax expenditures. I think it would be great to have a group of employers kind of look at those two lists, at the needs and the opportunities for STEM kind of investments and the tax expenditures, because that's either way, we're spending taxpayer dollars. And basically recommend to the legislature, we think, you know, these two on this list are so important that we as employers would recommend eliminating these two on this list in order to pay for it. Because that, I think, makes your case so much more effective to legislators, because then it's not just saying invest more money in this, but it's saying we believe so strongly in this that we're willing to help identify the resources to pay for it.
Representative Hunt, I can't agree with you more.
Representative Imbro.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So when we first, you know, I think the initial spark for this task force was actually when we had a report from ETIC a couple of years ago before this committee, and talking about the problem of the number of students who were in ETIC programs, you know, that is, were at, you know, university or graduate level, how a relatively small number of those students were actually Oregon high school graduates, right? You know, we identified that problem, that students from Oregon are not coming to university or, you know, or community college or, you know, to higher ed with the requisite skills to major in engineering areas, for example. But then in addition to that, a big drop-off once, you know, they may have intended to major in engineering or some other STEM area, but they then get diverted over the course of their higher education. And, you know, we saw in one of those slides that only 14%, I think, was the figure of our top science and engineering students actually graduate in STEM. So, you know, one of the things that we wanted the task force to look at was, you know, why is that happening? What are the barriers that students are facing that's causing them to get diverted, as it were? And what can we do to overcome those barriers? And, you know, I'm wondering, you know, were there conversations around that? And, you know, what ideas are out there? You know, I mean, I love the partnerships that you're proposing, you know, at the pre-college level. But what's being contemplated at the post-secondary level?
Representative Dembro, to answer your question and not answer your question at the same time, because I don't speak for the Oregon University system, and I think we have representatives that could do so much more educated than I am. I will argue this. In business, as well as many things, if you measure something, it tends to be focused on and worked on. One of the things that we don't do a good job at the university level is measuring retention. We do so in the business world. If I were to scrap 60% of my raw materials trying to build a product, I would quickly go out of business. And yet the university system routinely scraps over 60% of their STEM freshmen. Never make it to be STEM graduates. Something needs to change. Now, another typical business practice is root cause analysis, trying to figure out actually why are you scrapping those 60%. And it's a lot of reasons. Some of those reasons are certainly reasons we can't control. Family changes, life changes, whatever the case may be. Some we can. Are we bringing students to the ball game that are prepared to succeed at the university? Is the university doing everything they possibly can to give them support and help them through those first initial years that are so difficult? Is there a culture at the university of weeding out that used to exist in many STEM fields for years? I would argue that all those things have changed on their own over the time as things have moderated and migrated. But at the same time, unless there's a real focus on them, it won't happen fast enough. I think we're at a time that we need to start to measure retention as part of their overall performance. And again, I think that would start to lead to real successes. Again, when it comes to the why, it's a long list. Some of those things, again, can be dealt with. Some of them cannot. I hope that answers your question.
Terrell Smith, Sherwood, co-chairs and members. I'm also the track coach. I've discovered something about the long jump. Those who start way back in the track and they have a big old run up. You know, they're really, really have the speed up at the board, jump further than those who start at the board and jump stand. So you understand that analogy, and what the elements of this STEM task force says. Let's catch those kids. I think some answers are early. We have to provide out of school and in school STEM experiences to get them on back so that they can run up, and there's going to be more retention when they get there. And so we've lost many programs in Oregon in our high schools, the Saban Center and Hillsborough High School and Sherwood High School have a broad range of engineering and computer science courses, but many do not. And so the elements in the task force suggest ways to begin to build a beachhead for launching for the future on building a broader experience for our kids in school and out of school.
Representative Denbro, Representative Johnson, and members of the committee, I think what he just said is absolutely spot on. I think that's, thinking about it while he was speaking, that's why this is a K-20 initiative, not just a university initiative. I think what we realized, one of the lessons we came out of ETIC very quickly was that, yes, we could make some short-term changes very rapidly with ETIC at the university level, but long-term change needed to start to occur down at the K-12 realm. And that occurred at ETIC through OPAS and those minor investments, literally just $800,000 of biennium investments and trying to get those kids ready. But it's remarkable, even minor investments used appropriately can have a real impact. I think the other ultimate piece here is setting the bar higher and changing the culture within the system, and that is a long-term goal. And but ultimately, we have to set a priority to STEM in the state, and to do so means to start to actually act on it starting at this level.
Can I just do a follow-up?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. Thanks, Sherry. You know, one of the there are a lot of analogies between STEM and what we call CTE, career technical ed. And I'm thinking, within the community college world, students who are in technical programs, 2-year programs, they tend to graduate at a much higher rate than just general education students. Mm-hmm. So there's something about the clarity of the career path that they're on, the fact that they're kind of working in teams, as it were, The classes tend to be a little smaller. You know, they're more hands-on. I mean, you know, there's a lot of very high-level reasoning there, but it, you know, it's being done in a, you know, a project-based kind of a approach. And I'm just wondering if, you know, if we can somehow transfer that over to, you know, the more classic, you know, university STEM, you know, to, are there lessons to be learned in that world that can be applied to the engineering world?
Deb's coming up. Yeah, I'll say this, that STEM, from my standpoint, again, although it was 25 years ago I was in that position, I can still remember it vividly and trying to decide what I wanted to do with myself as I graduated high school. I will argue that how I learned math by itself was a dreadful subject for me. Physics was not much better because of the application of that math that I wasn't very strong at. Science was more interesting. Biology and life science and those things were quite interesting. But at the same time, I never really saw myself doing much with it as I moved forward. It wasn't literally until my senior year in high school that I started to have applications of science, applications of math, that kind of lit a little bit of a spark in me to want to maybe go forward and be an engineer or to do something in a STEM field. When I got to the university and I started in my freshman year, I quickly found that it was too late for me to suddenly become a math wizard and be able to compete in those classes. And I find myself being washed out very quickly from that standpoint. I think that's part of the root cause. I'm not unique. I think that's we come too late to the party, so to speak. So science and math, those parts of STEM, I know we have to call it STEM, but it's the E. And the E isn't just engineering like a lot of people think engineering is, of design. You know, it's the application of knowledge to solve problems that turn kids on. And that's where I'll hand it over to Deb, because that's what FIRST does, and that's how you get kids excited.
Well, thank you so much, co-chairs Dembro and Johnson and the committee. So this is my sweet spot in what I do in my day job, but yet I also have great access to the Gates Foundation people and Microsoft, because I also cover the states of Washington and Alaska in my job. And Gates has a fantastic slide that they show you, that they spent hundreds of millions of dollars on science and math curriculum, and the needle didn't move. And so they're backing off of education a little bit, and they're kind of taking a world health view. But when they do invest, it's in technology and engineering curriculum programs, which are project-based. Again, engineering doesn't mean that you're going to become a mechanical engineer. It could be a water-based. It could be clean energy. It could be biomedical. It just means it's the project-based learning with high tech and the science, and that's where the child engages, because the 90% of it is engaging the child so that they will go into achievement, so that they have that pathway. And the science and math learning falls right into that mode of it. And it's so critical. When we've worked with Microsoft and their senior vice president, her name is Lisa Brummel. She's a very lively woman who I have the ability to spend time with. And when Microsoft wants to launch a new product, say it was a Kinect, and they call them SBA, Small Business Accelerators, they bring the best and brightest from their own cubicles. They steal them from Google and Amazon, and they recruit them from top universities across the world. And she said to me, she said, Debbie, we know smart. We can figure out smart from a Vita. We can from a resume. But they've got it down to one question to figure out if this group of brilliant minds can bring a conceptual idea and a product to market. And that question is, are you a tinker or are you a hobbyist? Are you using a drill press? Are you using a lathe? Do you know how to create? And I think they're on to something, because that is so key. And Microsoft will name the year that they were not able any longer to find that skill set off of American soil. It was 1992. And they, not that we've done studies on this, but we feel that's when the shop classes closed pretty much across the United States, and everybody was closed. So you were definitely on to something. Representative Dembro, it's near and dear to my heart. We've just put out the second generation of Oregon students who come into our program and say, what's a Phillips screwdriver? They've never touched a screwdriver. And those are things that we think, once we can put tools, literal tools in their hand, they'll excel. Woodburn right now, we're working with them. They're struggling to teach the ESL students math, but their wood shop burnt down. Well, a drill press has an X and a Y slope. And if we could just teach X and Y slope on a drill press, I think you're going to see math achievement come up. But that's a big problem to address in this state.
One of the things about your report that I think excites me as much as anything is this concept of hubs. It's over the last year or so, I think I've come to the realization that, you know, just as OSU has a system of ag extension offices across the state that are placed strategically to help our ag community with needs that they have that are specific to those regions of Oregon, we need a system of high-tech or STEM extension offices also that are regionally based, that through which we can provide instruction, innovation, partnership with listening, obviously, respond to the needs of the business community in those regions. And I'm really hopeful that you're always going to need a model. You're going to need something that people can look at and say it works. And I think we've got a great opportunity to put one of those right in my hometown in Hood River.
Volunteering.
Well, we're down the road. And the thing that's fascinating is that, and Eric would probably second this, is that, you know, the business community is way ahead of us in the need for this. They are driving this. And in my hometown, they are definitely driving this. And we're creating a consortium now with our community college there. It's going to start there. We're going to have the higher ed piece for an expanded campus that will provide an opportunity for our universities to be able to provide some real targeted, business-focused, four-year degree possibilities in the community. That's exactly what the in-situs of the world need, who are unmanned aerial vehicle manufacturers or other spinoff companies there. They're asking for the specific skill set that they need. The other part that I'm going to interject into the midst as a school board member is that we also then place a 612 charter school, STEM charter school, in that campus as well. So we now have a ramp up for those students you're talking about. We can give them that running start, starting at sixth grade on a STEM-focused curriculum, to where when they come out now, they get close to finish. Obviously, you're going to have some dual accreditation going on big time. You're going to have internship opportunities. You're going to have mentorship opportunities. Because you've got a charter school, you can have some business folk come in there and share their knowledge in a way directly with the student population that I think is going to be an incredible model for the rest of the state. So we're very excited about the possibilities that we could have maybe one of those first quote-unquote hubs right in the Gorge area. But it's being driven by the private sector.
Absolutely.
They are saying, if you don't do this, we will. We will plant that school. We will create that environment because they believe in it so much.
Mr. Chair, if I may, that realization and recognition is part of why I requested that these people come be a big part of this presentation, and why I tried to ensure that the voice of those folks in the trenches from high school on up through president of TimberCon and other high-tech employers had their voice very present and strong in the hearings and in the report that we wrote and in the legislature that we're bringing forward.
Perfect.
Whatever money we are able to come up with is going to be highly leveraged by this community. So,
Rep. Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And this question is probably for you, Deb, or you, Representative Harker.
Actually, if it's really brief, I can do it. I have a meeting with Dr. Kitzhaber in just a few minutes. So,
so as I went through your report here, I love the way you laid it out. So thank you. And if you need to take off, we'll connect it.
You do know where to find me.
I think I know where that's at. So one of the nine charges of the task force was the last one here, identify ways to engage families and communities in support of STEM education. And I haven't completely digested this. I've not seen a great deal outside of partnerships with businesses alluded to in this document. Maybe I'm missing it for sure. And then I want to pull this together with another piece. It talks about the 4 to 7 regional STEM hubs. And Representative Johnson kind of began down this road, and I've had several of you know where I'm going because I've had one-on-one conversations with you. So you're grinning and you're waiting for me to be quiet so you can tell me when this is coming to Lebanon. But the question isn't quite that simple. You also talked about this being a part of a community's culture and reaching down into elementary school. That is where this ninth, if you will, point is absolutely key. In the discussions, I admit I was a little disappointed because I have some STEM envy and some issues with that. As I look at this report, I'm not seeing a lot of conversation about outlying areas, rural areas, smaller communities, smaller industries. I don't have a lot of those in my backyard, but I have smaller ones that employ the same type of skills and provide the same quality and value and service. Talk to me about that conversation, kind of ease some of that concern I'm feeling right now, and how this is going to reach out into the rest of the state.
Representative Springer, to answer your question, one of the tenets of the legislative concept is to form a council that has the ability to, after identifying these concerns, and what you're bringing up are common concerns, to prioritize through an RFP process which things you want to solve first and in which order. So underrepresented groups by ethnicity, by gender, or by geography have always been quickly on the top of the list. And I think what's nice about having a council using an RFP process, it gives tremendous flexibility to put out and modify those RFPs to meet particular needs at that time. So an RFP around hubs will work in many of the communities, for example, in the state that have strong industry support, strong educational support, and parent support. In some communities, they may not work, and therefore we have to have the flexibility to think of another way to meet those needs. And that's what's I've always enjoyed at ETIC, is that we're not bound by such specifics in the legislation to tell us exactly how to solve the problem. Instead, we rely on a lot of really smart people to figure out how to solve that problem as it changes and it morphs over the years that we envision this council being in place. So I don't think there's a single solution across the state, but there are definitely best practices across the state, and there are definitely best targets across the state.
Deb Mumhill from FIRST, and just to add on to what Eric Meslow said is we looked at a number of different states. I'm from Iowa. I'm married a farm boy, and Oregon's very much like Iowa. It's just that it's flipped, where very rural, where there's an I-80 in going through Iowa, Interstate 80 is where the population is, and everything else is sparse. And so one of the things that Governor Branstad and they did with their universities, their community colleges, and even their private universities, is they split the state into the six regions and called them STEM and created STEM hubs there. And so that is one way to try to address the rural. I don't know if that's the correct way for here. I end up getting phone calls from the Wind Energy Foundation, who wanted to be on our tail out of Washington, D.C., because they're desperate for technicians who know C Rios and Jaguars, because technically those wind turbines are robots, and they wanted to know how they could have access to our kids to try to build that task, you know, to try to build somebody who wants to live in Condon, Oregon. And it's hard to get somebody to move from a metro area to move to those smaller areas. Same with John Deere tractors. You know, when I grew up on them, they were a clutch and not even a key, and now they're the cockpit of a 747. They are extremely complicated. They're a $500,000 investment, and so I hear you loud and clear. I think our task force does too, that we absolutely have to bring these opportunities to the rural area, and it depends on how much money we get and what we can do, but if we have to turn on a dime, I think we're going to end up really bringing together the community colleges, if there's a university there, the workforce development councils, and you know, it takes a village to inspire a child to build a robot. We've been doing this for 20 years, it's going to take the exact same in STEM. One thing that we haven't talked a lot about is healthcare nationally. Every town has a clinic. Every town has dentists. Right now, when we look at nationally at our unemployment stats for anybody who has a two-year or higher degree in healthcare, it's a 1.7 unemployment rate. So there are so many possibilities on how we can take these hubs or whatever they're going to end up looking like to make sure that we're not just in our I-5 corridor from Eugene to Vancouver, but that we will be scalable and blanketing the state. And it's going to look a little different for each region.
Greenlick, do you have anything to add?
Thank you. I have a comment I'd like to.
Can you stay? We've got to adopt some LC draft real
quick. I know. It'll probably end with a question to Mr. Smith. I have a son-in-law who grew up in his dad's construction business, building and doing woods from the time he was in diapers, ended up getting an industrial arts teacher certification at Maine, came out to Portland to become an industrial arts teacher, middle school industrial arts teacher, taught the traditional stuff, and then invented at Tubman something called the Star Lab, Science, Technology, and Research, which did very much the things we're talking about. That eventually disappeared. He went to work as a teacher on assignment funded by a foundation to teach system sciences into the curriculum in middle school. And he's now retired. And I think he was the second to last industrial arts certified teacher in the Portland Public School System. I think there's one or maybe a couple more. You obviously need these industrial art teachers, and it seems to me that we've eaten the seed corn. And is there any way that we can get back a flow of these industrial art teachers who know how to show somebody how to use a drill press, for example, on a lathe? And it seems hopeless to me.
Before you answer, we've got a little bit of procedural work that we have to get done. I'm going to open up a quick work session so we can adopt the legislative concepts that we need to, and then we can continue on and let you. So hold that thought, if you will.
Roger that.
Just think quorum.
With that, I'll open up a work session for the purpose of introducing some legislative drafts into committee bills for next session. Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And before I move these, let me just clarify that committee measures, the approval of committee measures does not indicate, voting for the introduction of a committee measure doesn't mean that we agree with these measures. We're getting them into the process, and then they will be referred to committees. Many of them will come here, but not all of them will. And they will then have a subsequent life or not. So, Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 168, relating to correction of erroneous material in Oregon law.
Could be a big bill.
LC 978, relating to education. That's our university governance bill. LC 1923, relating to public charter schools. LC 1950, relating to enrollment in virtual public charter schools, LC 2062, relating to higher education employees, LC 2116, relating to public charter schools, LC 2304, relating to Achievement Compact Advisory Committees, LC 2672, relating to study of the operation of public universities, and LC 2673, relating to the study of the operation of public universities.
Thank you. So Representative Dimbro moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 168, LC 978, LC 1923, LC 1950, LC 2062, LC 2116, LC 2304, LC 2672, and LC 2673. Is there any further discussion about these? Is there any objection? If not, so moved. With that, we'll close the work session for the purpose of introducing legislative concepts. I need to be excused as well. We have a caucus meeting that was called for 4 o'clock. As you all know, the governor kind of has thrown a few extra measures of work on our plates this week, so we have a few unscheduled meetings, as I'm sure you all can understand, to be able to comply with what we're being asked to do. So I just want to, before I go, thank very much the panel. You guys did a wonderful job. And this is actually the last bid for our committee as well, and I want to thank you for, Mr. Chair, working with you. It's been a pleasure, and really, I think we've been successful, and I think can be proud of our accomplishments over the last couple of years, certainly the last year since we became a standalone committee and they took the training wheels off and, and let us fly. So with that, Representative Greenlick, I'm sorry for the interruption.
No problem, and I'll just point out for the record that what you have left is quality, if not quantity.
I'll talk to you a little later. Yeah.
Okay. Cheryl Smith, Sherwood School District, Representative Greenlick, and members, remaining members. I don't know that I have an answer. I know that Oregon State has the capacity to train more. I know that the discouragement of graduates because programs have been cut in Portland Public Schools and in other districts, programs have been cut, and so the opportunities for them doesn't happen to be there. So I don't know the full answer to it, but we have, we've been able to expand our program in Sherwood, and some do, some can, and you know, we become a model then for this turnaround, if you will, which this STEM task force suggestions hopefully will help foster. And then Savannah will have something very pertinent for this. I want to just make one comment that Sherwood High School has been a pretty good football school. We won 5A state champion here recently. Kids in the elementary level don't have to pay to play. And they have community members coaching them, volunteer. They raise money. They don't have to pay to play. There are kids all over Sherwood playing football. Football, if there were careers in football that everybody could have access to, all these kids would go do that. They are so excited about it. That is a model for what we're trying to do, for what ETIG did, for what eChamp is doing, and what Savannah is the poster girl for in catching those kids at that young level. And the sports program is our model. We're talking about what about models? What about families? What about that young students and those families involved? eChamp is an answer for that kind of work.
So, Savannah Lobiger, Hillsborough High School. My teacher, Mr. Don Domes, he always tells me that, well, he shares with people that come to our engineering department that in Oregon, I believe, it's a significantly less than 20 certified CTE teachers in all of Oregon. In the past couple years, we've gone from 5.5 engineering, computer science, technical teachers to, I believe it's 3. And when kids see that, kids don't want to take the classes. I would love to become a teacher so much. I mean, teaching is my passion. It's one of my passions. But when my teacher, Mr. Jones, tells me that he knows that he cannot encourage me to go down and become a teacher because that's not where I'm going to get paid. That's not where I'm guaranteed to have a job. So there are people that are going the professional route. And then my physics teacher, she came back and is now teaching. After she went out, she got her patents and all this. She had her career. So there are engineers going down that path, but it's hard when we're not guaranteed that we're going to have that job. And so I think that there needs to be more value put into that. And if I believe in our legislature, we have a suggestion that it's a 0.5 technical credit for graduation. There's something mentioned in that. And if we add that throughout Oregon, then there'll be more value in technology classes, and then we'll have more technology teachers. Thank you.
That was very well stated, Savannah. And, I think it really speaks to what Rep. Greenlick was saying about eating our seed corn. If we don't have teachers, the teachers who are retiring aren't being replaced, So who's going to teach the kids that are going to become passionate about CTE, you know, et cetera? The other thing that's happening, you know, I think one of the causes for traditionally for success in CTE programs is those student organizations that do a lot after school, outside of school. I mean, the classic one is Future Farmers of America, mm-hmm. you know, for agriculture students. They are disappearing, frankly. They're the first things to be cut. And then the programs are diminished, the teachers are gone, and we're left with nothing. So we're going to be talking a lot about this committee will be talking a lot about this in the next session, how we can restore the commitment. You know, it may not be your, you know, the traditional, you know, shop class at every high school, you know, full-fledged shop. We may have some partnerships.
Every middle school.
But, I mean, it may be some partnerships where there's, you know, a magnet school within a district that different, you know, kids can spend part of their time. Everybody has access to it in a regional kind of basis, or partnerships with the community college in the area, partnerships with business and industry. We have to think about it in a different way, but while maintaining that core commitment to it. Yeah. Bruce, did you want to say something? Okay.
Mind the mic?
Yeah. Come and introduce yourself.
Bruce Schaefer with the Oregon University System, Chancellor's Office. I won't go into a lot of detail now, but the Next Generation Science Standards incorporate scientific and engineering practices in the teaching of the content. This is an exciting opportunity for Oregon because we're one of the 26 lead states. At a different juncture, I can explain some things we're already doing in anticipation of that and things more that we can do going forward to integrate these hands-on experiences into science classes and better connect in mathematics.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. And we'll be talking about that next session, too, just the way the new Common Core State Standards are really, the assessment pieces are not just multiple choice. They're really problem-solving kinds of activities, which I think makes many of us very excited.
Build a birdhouse like the terrible one I built in Woodshop.
To that point, Representative Greenlake, I grew up in Oregon, went to school K through 12 here, and as well as the university system, and I was proud. I took every shop class in middle school I could, and frankly, I think I took 4 years of shop in middle class all through high school. It was one of my favorite things to do. I would argue, however, that if I was put back into high school at this time, I wouldn't want the shop class that I had back then, because it would frankly not be, the birdhouse was great, but if I'm going to do a birdhouse, I wanted to design it in a 3D software CAD program first.
CAD, right.
I want to do a 3D prototype with a printer, and then I'm going to ultimately want to use a CNC machine to cut it out.
And you're going to want to study something about the birds that are going to,
exactly.
are going to be in there.
Bingo.
In your science course. I mean, that's exactly yeah.
And you tie all that together, and you'll have inspired graduates at that point, and you'll have, frankly, even at the coming right out of 12th grade, you'll have a better work-ready workforce than we currently have.
Okay. Can I just ask Savannah, what are your plans for next year? You're a senior this year, right?
Yes.
What are your plans for next year?
That's a very good question.
Number one.
I'm still in the process of applying to many schools. I am, of course, looking at OSU as one of them. If I can, I would like to stay in Oregon, but when MIT is asking to interview me and I have Georgia Tech flying me out there, it's tough to say no to them. I would, however, like to get a degree in biomedical engineering or a dual degree in mechanical engineering and computer science, and I would like to get my PhD after that.
And I would just add on as another future career possibility for you, in addition to the ones you've talked about, legislator.
Well, to Savannah.
Yeah, it's a really well-paid job.
About the same as science teachers.
Exactly. The brain drain in this state is extraordinary. One thing I can talk to is about the fact that, for a lot of reasons, some of our best students leave the state and go on to different universities. And for a lot of reasons, you can't blame them. MIT is a great school. You might have heard of it. The fact of the matter, though, is the percentage of students that then come back to this state and find jobs when they leave for those institutions is remarkably low, at least in the beginning. They may come back as they start to pine for their old home, you know, 20 years from now after they graduate. But boy, if you go up, if you go to New England for school, the chances are you're going to stay in New England and work. And we're losing some of our absolute best talent that into that. So trust me, after the speech at the Leadership Summit, I corralled every single representative of Oregon State University from the president to the dean of engineering and introduced them to Savannah. So hopefully we can keep Savannah in the state.
I'm surprised you didn't think of the Naval Academy. You'd be a great officer.
But both my parents were Marine Corps officers, and I was considering Annapolis. However, I moved past it now, and now it's my brother's goal. So.
Well, thank you, all of you, for, you know, coming forth today. Rep. Parker for chairing this task force.
My pleasure.
And, you know, we look forward to receiving the legislation and working it next session and, you know, building what we know needs to be built. What a way to end this on an engineering kind of term.
Okay. There you go.
So, thank you again. So with that, I'm going to close this information hearing and... we are adjourned for the duration of this session.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you all.